responsibility is so good. It feels so natural.
What's something you've written and you've just gone, I can't know?
You can look at it and kind of try and learn from the things you've been through.
You write songs, right?
I've read that a few times too. I know, we've sold that many records.
This week on The Best Bits, do you remember the clip for Band-Aid's Do They Know It's Christmas? Or Guns N' Roses' Sweet Child of Mine? And Oasis's Wonderwall? Well, director Nigel Dick created these iconic videos, and you'll find out what it was like to not only work with these huge artists, you'll find out how a band's attitude on set may relate to the rest of their career. This week, our feature album has been provided by duo The Kills. Singer Alison Mosshart explained how she and bandmate Jamie Hintz find being irrationally uncomfortable a positive space to be in. You'll also meet Liz Hamm, an accomplished photographer who's part of an ongoing passion project that captures images of bold, fierce women in the punk scene. That's The Kills on Double J. Alison Mosshart and Jamie Hintz together. Heart of a Dog from the new album that we're featuring all this week here on Double J, Ash and Ice. And it seems like that album was born of great change that was pushed on by, well, you could say it was a pretty gruesome injury, which was not pleasant at all, but who knew that a torn tendon in Jamie Hintz's guitar hand and the possibility of losing his finger would be the thing that pushed The Kills to write the album that they did and also force them to play around with some of the new sounds that you can hear on that particular track. So it seems like sometimes the worst things can actually bring out the best in people, which is good news. I talked about all of this with singer-songwriter Alison Mosshart on the phone. And she's really excited about this new album for all of those reasons, and also that she's loving playing the new songs live.
Oh, yeah, it's been brilliant. We've been playing the new songs for like the last 3 months in Europe and America, and it's been awesome. It's been really great.
That's great. What is it about the new songs that you're really enjoying playing? Is it because the album is new and still feels pretty special and fresh?
Yeah, it's because they're new. I mean, you know, you tour your record for 2-3 years, you know,
yeah.
And then by the end of that, you're really ready to play other things. And it just makes the set exciting, you know, to play stuff that hasn't been played a million times and feels new and you have no idea how it's going to be. And just is like an element of excitement and adrenaline that's different from playing songs that you've been playing for half your life.
Yeah, exactly. You're here in Australia in July, which will be fantastic. How long has it been since you guys have been here?
Way too long.
Yeah.
I'm not actually sure. You know, it's been a really long time.
Yeah, it all starts to run into one after a while, doesn't it?
Well, the thing is, you know, you guys are so far away. It's not an easy hop and skip. It's a big old commitment to come down there. So I'm really, really excited we're going to come and be there for a little while. It's going to be nice.
So good, so good. Hey, congratulations on the album. I love it. The songs are just fantastic.
Thank you.
And it was a long time coming for many obvious reasons. Do you want to talk through that? I guess Jamie's hand, that business happening in the middle of it, and then, you know, you being busy with other projects, both of you, in fact, being busy with other projects. How did you manage to finally pull this together?
It's actually a lot more simple than it sounds. I mean, we toured Blood Pressures for close to 3 years, and actually we were still playing shows for Blood Pressures in 2015. And in the middle, like somewhere in late 2014, Jamie injured his hand, and that was a major drag because he had to have 6 surgeries to get a tendon transplant. He lost a tendon in his middle finger on his fretting hand due to slamming his hand in the car door and it breaking, and then a doctor mistreating it and it becoming, he had a deep bone infection, which he just basically ravaged his hand. So it was pretty serious and pretty grim, and it took a really long time and a lot of surgeries to get him going again. But in a positive way, you know, because he couldn't play guitar and he only had one hand, he decided to basically build a studio. And he got really interested in software and Pro Tools and lots of crazy gear and started kind of putting together this sort of masterpiece of a studio, and figuring out what kind of sounds he was interested for the for this record, and he had the time to do that, which was really nice. And I think that you can really hear the leaps and bounds that he took, you know, in a production sense on this record compared to the one before it. And I don't know if he hadn't injured his hand and had all that time to himself to discover these things and teach himself these things, I think the record would sound really different. You know, I think it would have been a record that was written in a more traditional way. You know, we always write on acoustic guitar. You start with a melody and lyrics and work your way through beats and everything like that at the end and sort of find his style. But because he was limited in that, he kind of worked backwards in a very cool way. So the goal for every record is to try to push it to a place that seems insanely, irrationally uncomfortable for us.
Yeah.
You know, and then you find your footing there, and that's when you know you're doing something new. And it can be a really long journey that's at times rather painful and annoying to try to do something that you don't feel that you're very good at, you know. And it's easy to write the same song again and again and again. In fact, it's fun, but it's different to try to do something that you don't know how to do and achieve that.
This week on doublej.net.au.
Mick Warhurst remembers the inappropriate songs she sang along to as a kid and finds out about the naughty songs kids are singing these days. Not a fan of The Avalanche's new single, Frankie Sinatra? Tim Scheel has some advice to help you deal with your feelings. And learn more about how punk has impacted the UK over the years in this week's J-Files feature.
Check out all these articles and more, plus stream the week's shows on doublej.net.au.
Miff's Best Bits on Double J.
I'm joined by a very special guest right now, Liz Hamm, who's a photographer. She photographs images for all the big magazines in Australia and probably internationally, for all I know as well. And she's done something particularly of interest this month here on Double J as we celebrate four decades of punk here on Double J. And she's got a whole bunch of photos of Australian women, and it's called Punk Girls. And you can look it up online if you want to while we're talking. It's lizhampunkgirls.tumblr.com. And they are beautiful photos. And I've got Liz in the studio. Hi, Liz. Welcome.
Hello.
It's so good to see photographs of women in punk, and particularly contemporary punk.
Yep.
Because punk's not over. It hasn't finished.
Oh, no way.
No, no. So how did you get the idea of doing this particular photographic series?
Well, I guess growing up in the 80s and punk just being all around, you know, it became sort of omnipresent. So it's always been in my world, in my life. And I kind of feel like I reached a stage where I sort of organically fell into this project just because of people I was meeting, things I was doing. I've always had a sort of documentary photographic practice in addition to my fashion and portraiture practice. And the more I felt, you know, looking at these images of contemporary women, I felt that, and especially in the history of punk, that women were unrepresented and misrepresented, and in a more contemporary sense, also very much like fetishized.
Yes.
And so I kind of was also very keen to explore the male dominated side of punk and how that then would affect these women and how they would use that domination to perhaps, you know, kind of subvert things and empower themselves throughout that process.
It's so interesting. We reviewed a punk doco on Monday, and it was about women in UK punk in the 70s and a lot of their message. And we never really hear that side so much. Yeah. More so now, but perhaps back it was predominantly when I was growing up learning about music and punk, mm-hmm. it was all about men.
Yep.
Let's be honest. But there were loads of female punks and loads of female punk bands. But the whole thing about the way they were dressing, which was really empowering for them, was that it was not about the male gaze.
Exactly.
It was actually about dressing for themselves, and it was about dressing for, you know, and not attracting that, but actually feeling and also feeling part of a tribe. Yeah. It's so fascinating. Has that continued on, do you think, in contemporary punk dressing, or has it changed?
I think it evolves and it continues, and it just changed. I don't know, it's very hard to sort of define punk these days, and people get very heated as well when I say I'm doing a book on punk girls, I'd love to photograph you. They say I'm not a punk, but I say, well, let's just think about, you know, your way of life and how you feel about the world. And they're like, oh yeah, I am a punk, I guess. So how we look doesn't necessarily even matter. It's about our attitude inside. You know, so I'm all of that belief that it's who you are and not what you wear. But having said that, I absolutely love the aesthetics of punk, and you know, I love a leather jacket, I love studs, I love all of that. And that's what probably drew me in, you know, when I was 8 and saw the punks at Paddington Markets and loving the Young Ones, all of that stuff.
The Young Ones, of course. Yes, that's how I got into it too.
I think so. I dressed up as Vivian for Book Week in 1984 because there was a book, thankfully, you know. That was my way.
Yeah, I see what you did there. Yeah, that's so good.
But I feel like, punk now is it's very diverse. There's so many subgenres. There's, you know, sort of queer punk, and there's the hardcore scenes and the DIY scenes and the crusty scenes. And I love all of it. I just think it's all absolutely fascinating.
Is there something more to it? Is it the people as well that are attracted to that scene that makes, I guess, your photographs have more meaning to you?
Because through the process, I mean, it's one thing to create an amazing image or a striking image or make somebody feel beautiful through that. But I feel like it's the storytelling aspect of this book as well that's really holding me in that place. And through the process of meeting women and photographing them, I also give them like a little questionnaire, and they fill out some really basic sort of and quite silly questions at times. But having the ability for them to share their story, I think, is really important. And you find, I find that there is so much power and so much resilience in these women and these girls. And a lot of them have been through some really hectic times. And a lot of them are just, you know, just so happy to be having fun. And it's this incredible, I guess, just representation of women in general. You know, we are, you know, it's a great cross section of society, but definitely the stronger women. Definitely.
All right, if you do want to see those images, it's part of an ongoing project that will eventually become a book, but look online right now because they're fantastic. I just think they're gorgeous. LizHamPunkGirls.tumblr.com.
Miff's Best Bits on Double J.
Director Nigel Dick is in the country to do some in-conversations and panel discussions about the nature of music videos here in Australia. And he's done an awful lot more since some of those huge 80s clips, like Do They Know It's Christmas? And, of course, Tears for Fears, Shout. We'll find out exactly what he's been up to as he joins me right now in the Double J studios. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
So good to talk to you. Such an honour.
Well, thank you.
You're part of my visual history.
I'm embarrassed now.
Don't be embarrassed. Take the compliment. Big question, though, because I always start with the serious issues. You made clips at the height of the excess of the 80s, okay? How much hairspray was used on the clip for Do They Know It's Christmas, featuring every single 80s star that I knew and loved?
I would actually say that Do They Know It's Christmas had very little hairspray because it was a Sunday morning, and actually most of the people showed up definitely recovering from the night before.
So they still had hairspray in from the night before?
Yeah, they were looking a bit bedraggled, most of them, actually, because I don't think they knew they were going to be filmed. The hairspray issue was much worse when I got into the Guns N' Roses, Def Leppard area.
Well, of course, you did Guns N' Roses, Patience, and Sweet Child of Mine.
Sweet Child of Mine, Welcome to the Jungle, Paradise City, Patience, and one other which I always forget the name of.
I love that. You've just done so many you forget the name of. You've worked with everyone, pretty much. Like, you know, I look through a who's who of 80s, 90s, 2000s, and now music. You've worked with everyone. Do tell us a story about Oasis and the making of Wonderwall, or just Oasis in general.
Well, I got a phone call from a guy who I'd done a bunch of videos before, who worked at Epic in New York. And he said, and I was living in LA at the time, and he says, I really think you should do some Oasis videos for us. And I've been reading about Oasis, and they're from Manchester in England. And they're, you know, they're very tough working class lads. And I'm like, I'm a middle class guy from Yorkshire, which is, you know, it's like the Wars of the Roses. And what transpired, he gave me the gig because I was the only guy he knew who could understand what they were saying. And so anyway, I got the gig, and in the middle of the video, they just started brawling. You know, Noel and Liam started having this fight.
Like fist fight or just verbal just, fight?
Well, just, you know, certain very colourful words were exchanged. And
they're good with the colourful words.
Oh, yeah,
too.
They're very good with the... And they were just, you know, rolling their eyes at each other and, you know, various signals. And, of course, you know, being a polite English chap, one doesn't expect this from two brothers. And the rest of the band seemed completely... you know, nonplussed by it. And it was just a very interesting moment for me. And the other thing, I remember two other things very vividly, apart from the fact that my producer left the set halfway through the day because his wife had a baby. And the other thing was, it was just at the birth of like cell phones in England. And yeah. Everybody was on their phone. So I had to take all the cell phones from my crew and lock them in a room so they'd actually work with me.
Because that would be the time when you used to get that interference as well, wouldn't it, with the cell phones?
I didn't care about the interference was that nobody was concentrating what we're trying to do.
And look what's happened to us now. None of us are concentrating on anything.
No. And, I eventually did five videos for them, and they were, never really engaged in making videos. It was a chore for them. Yeah. They wanted to come as late as possible and leave as early as possible.
Wow.
Which I found very interesting because, you know, I was spending some of their money, but they quite patently could give a damn.
Wow. Who else has been a bit like that? Are most of those really sort of high-end stars generally just try and get in and get out, or do they like to be involved in the creative process?
It varies. Huge, huge variety from people who come in very resentful from the get-go and stay resentful. And
why are they resentful? I'm interested in that. Is it just because it's more work?
Well, I mean, I was just telling somebody the other day a very interesting double act, if you like, as I did a video for a Canadian band. And they warned me that the lead singer would be very difficult to work with. And she came in the day before the video for a wardrobe dressing. And she just went through the clothes. I won't wear that. That's too thin. That's too fat. That shows too much. That doesn't show enough. This is too blue. This is too green. We had $50,000 worth of dresses there, and she wouldn't wear any of them. And it was a very difficult process. Two brothers are in the band. They were just... Oh, are you the director? We don't like directors, that kind of attitude.
What's happened? Why is this? I would assume, creative meeting.
Well,
with
you'd
minds.
Think, wouldn't you? And the thing that really brought it home was that I left the set next morning, got on the plane, flew to Prague to meet Celine, who was flying in from Bangkok after a gig.
When you say Celine, I'm assuming.
Celine Dion, you know, whose music I don't love, but... And she's a total sweetheart, you know, incredibly successful. And we were supposed to have a wardrobe fitting, just like the one I'd had 48 hours previously. And I said, you don't have to do this tonight. I know you just stepped off a plane, having flown 16 hours. And she's like, oh, are you kidding? Of course I want to try on the clothes. Aww. Come on, let's go. And, she was fantastic. And you suddenly realise, that's very interesting. Two people who have... the same investment in what I'm trying to do for them, and the results were a reflection of their attitudes rather than the work that I put in.
That's very interesting.
So, which is a lesson for us all, I think, about what we do in our daily lives.
Thank you.
catch up with Miff Warhurst for lunch. Weekdays from 11 on Double J.